shit real good. Push it. Push it good. Push it. Push it real good.
Crimes and Treasons.
Yes, yes, y'all.
Another episode in the bank.
What?
Crimes and Treasons versus what? Team Cream.
Versus. It's a fight.
Next week.
Ding ding, round one.
Maybe in weeks to come we'll have Cody back too.
From no, maybe. Texas,
and then we'll do like a.
I think he's lost in Texas. He won't be back. I don't blame him.
Team Cream's taking over. Stay tuned. Next week we're going to be offering you the latest in all types of polishes.
Polishes? And glosses.
Polishes and
blushes.
And glosses.
And headscarves.
You heard it first. 101.9 FM. Yeah. We got a couple dates we want to like break you off with just so you're all set up for your weekend as well. Tonight, Cherisee just hit you off with this last mix. She's going to be playing Hell's Kitchen. Get down there. Tomorrow
Sunday.
Night.
Oh. Don't forget tonight though.
Get drunk. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Tonight too.
Definitely
free
hip hop
show. Fabric. Formerly Sonar. Right? There's like eight acts or something going
eight
on.
Eight acts. Not sure all the acts, but I know it's definitely good local talent.
Yeah.
Check
new club Fabric, so that's going to be nice.
Not too shabby. If you're around town tomorrow, buy me a drink.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. We love you, Brandon.
And then Sunday, third installment of Protect Your Deck. Deck. At Republic. That's the big Wu-Tang party. Cherisee is going to be playing alongside the freshest kids. And then what's up next? I think there's something like a sweatshop party or something like that.
Sweatshop party, May 24th. B-O-O-T-A-Y.
Dope.
We don't need no alibi. It's at Sweatshop, May 24th. My gay husband, Rico Uno, me, Cherisee.
Big girls getting
big
free.
Big girls getting free. Last one was amazing, slamming.
Yeah.
Sweaty.
So now you know you're all laced up for your weekend and the next week to come. So
don't forget, teamcream.ca.
That's the one, teamcream.ca.
Plugging it.
Yeah, yeah. Be sure to get the new prints, the new t-shirts, and stay up on what's happening.
Congratulations to the winners.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mark, you're in for a Pimp C shirt.
And Boyd, right?
Boyd fam.
Okay.
See you at the Woo Party.
Buy me a drink.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Crimes and Treasons, we're out of here. Tune in next week.
Peace.
Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of my science project. Today's show is sort of a mishmash of two topics. One is about antibacterial soaps and hand washing. We'll be revisiting the superbug. And another is all about eating and diet. We'll look at, for example, how exercise could be able to make your DNA 10 years younger. And in between, I'll be spinning a group I've just come across recently called the Flowbots, kind of a hip-hop group that their songs are, I suppose, under the wire in terms of scientific content. But just in general, cool stuff, cool tunes that I'll spin for you today. And we'll travel over the next hour through interesting science news, stories, tidbits, music, and the lot. And wrap it up with some really cool science events and other sciencey-related stuff that's going on that you will probably want to participate in. But before we get to anything else, this is the first of our Flowbot songs. This is called The Moon.
traveling the land from gravel into sand, not knowing where I'm going, never having any plans. Anything I wanted, had to grab it in advance. Abracadabra, there's a rabbit in my hands, cause I've got the magic stick, bust the baddest tricks, fish for a whale, brought a ship up out of it. What's that I just saw? A platypus? Nah, maybe it's a rat crawling flat on his paws, or a baby dragon just dragging his claws. It doesn't really matter because it's Saturday, so look that away. 3 o'clock matinee, let's collaborate, and I'll pay you back soon with a crazy rap tune. But for now, I'm just gazing at the moon. Now 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 I'm just gazing at the moon.
Wander and ponder the pale blue yonder to infinity and beyond the city. Beyond the city, we all want to see serenity. But sometimes you gotta hop the fence to see that all sidewalks must end eventually. I sit still at the bottom of the sea. Brain waves chill like I see an enemy. Sentient entity, let the spirit into me. Patient, pervasive, how I was meant to be. A stone warns me by the swift currents of chaos. A place to lay a thick array of lush moss. I'm parlaying on my day off, floating way off on my thought balloons and snacking on macaroons. But for now, I'm just gazing at the
now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now, just gazing at the now.
A couple of years ago, I did a feature on superbugs with Anne, and we talked about, in particular, a program that was established by someone named Dr. Edith Blundell Hill, who set up, and you can see this online as well, something called Do Bugs Need Drugs? The website's www.dobugsneeddrugs.org. And this was to raise awareness about the importance of simple hand washing and the trend in what are called superbugs, which are bacteria that have developed resistance to traditional antibiotics, in large part because of the overuse and misuse of antibiotics in our medical system. This case is still relevant because even as early as last week, there were reports in various Canadian media about the prevalence of a bacteria called Clostridium difficile, or C. difficile, which probably a lot of you have heard of. And then in Ontario, there were a very large number of cases of C. diff reported, and Ontario has responded in terms of now demanding greater reporting and better reporting of these cases, because it's estimated that 1,200 people will die before the end of the year as a result of these kinds of infections in hospitals. C. difficile itself is normally fine for healthy people, but it's when people are on a course of antibiotics that C. diff takes hold, because it disrupts the normal balance of bacteria in the body, because the antibiotics the patient's taking have suppressed the normal healthy bacteria that normally would exclude the effects of C. diff. And C. diff is transmitted through fecal matter, so poo, basically. And you pick it up through contamination, and it creates all kinds of digestive issues. The most serious one, really, the one that people tend to die from, is diarrhea. Clearly, antibacterial resistance is still a problem. It's still an issue. And it's particularly irksome to me when I see so many ads in print or on the television espousing the benefits of using antibacterial soaps. In fact, Scientific American, in February of this year, in their Fact or Fiction section, dedicated a page to the question, do antibacterial soaps do more harm than good? Traditionally, people have washed bacteria from our bodies through soap and hot water, or alcohol, or other things like bleach. Soap works by loosening and lifting dirt away and basically sloughing off bacteria, oil, and microbes from the surface of our skin. Other cleaners like alcohol actually destroy the cells themselves and then evaporate. But products containing antibacterial agents actually leave surface residues. And this is a problem, because when a bacterial population survives the first hit of an antibacterial agent, then continues in the presence of the lingering chemical or residue, a small subpopulation of the bacteria become armed with a special defense mechanism. And this evolves rapidly, because bacteria reproduce rapidly, and so antibacterial resistance happens fast. However, resistance to topical chemicals isn't the only risk to humans, because when bacteria become tolerant to these compounds, they sometimes also become less sensitive to certain antibiotic medicines. This is called cross-resistance, and it's already been demoed with something called triclosan, one of the most common chemicals in antibacterial products. Other mutations can allow microbes to supercharge something called an efflux pump. These are protein machines in the cell membrane that can spit out several types of antibiotics. Scientists have further concerns about antibacterial compounds, because both triclosan and its close chemical relative triclocarbon are present in 60% of American streams and rivers. Triclosan has also been found in human breast milk and in human blood plasma, and although there's no evidence to date that suggests that this is a risk to us, recent studies do suggest that it compromises the function of the hormone system in not only bullfrogs, but also in rats. Basically, the value of antibacterial additives is incredibly questionable. An expert panel convened by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration determined that there's insufficient evidence for any benefit from consumer products containing antibacterial agents. The consensus is that good hygiene means using regular soaps rather than antibacterial ones, and using these soaps to wash your hands at least 3 times a day, and keeping your dirty little fingers away from your mucous membranes, like your nose and your eyes, and not sucking your fingers or sticking your fist in your mouth. A very recent story was published in Science just at the beginning of April, and it was reported in The Scientist, where hundreds of bacteria have been isolated from soil samples that are able to live exclusively on antibiotics as a food source. George Church of Harvard Medical School led the research team, and they isolated bacteria from 11 distinct soil types and found that in their culture system, in some cases, 13 to 17 of 18 classes of antibiotics were enough to fuel and sustain the bacteria. This included penicillin and ciprofloxacin, these very common antibiotics that we use. The good spin on this story is that the new findings may help researchers understand the bacterial mechanisms of resistance, as well as other practical applications. Because the idea is that perhaps these organisms can actually be used to remove antibiotic contamination in the environment. I mentioned that the antibiotic soaps are the ones that leave behind this residue that then continues to have an impact on the bacteria because they're able to evolve resistance to it. So having an identified group of bacteria that can break down and digest antibiotics could be used in water treatment plants, for example, to remove excess antibiotics leached into runoff by farms and other human activity. Because let's not forget that when you're washing your hands with something that's an antibacterial soap, all of that's going down the drain and into our water supply and impacting the bacteria out in the natural world. I don't know if you guys, any of you work in hospitals or had to go to a hospital in the last while, which is probably unfortunate, but because I work in the close proximity of the Foothills Medical Hospital at the University of Calgary, I've seen them implement a program that I really appreciate, and it's actually a gel alcohol system where they have these little dispensers set up pretty much all over the hospital. So at any given time, you can just give the dispenser a pump and you get an alcohol gel that is antibacterial, and it destroys the bacteria, but it evaporates. It doesn't leave a residue. And there was actually a study published in Open Access, a journal called Critical Care, volume 11 in 2007, that tested hand hygiene practices. It's kind of spooky, actually, that overall compliance with hand hygiene practices among nurses, physicians, nursing assistants, and other healthcare workers was essentially below 50%. The worst offenders were the other healthcare workers at about 14% compliance for hand hygiene. Nurses were about 40%. Physicians were about 30%. And it's a sad fact that actually doctors are among, and healthcare workers are among the worst offenders for regularly cleaning their hands. So when you have a doctor examine you, you might want to take care that you wash whatever, you know, just make yourself clean afterwards, because they tend to, for whatever reason, have contamination on their hands. So this gel formulation actually turned out to be the best one that people would tend to use when they're healthcare workers. And in fact, having really ready access to these types of gels was the best way to get healthcare workers to regularly practice good hand hygiene. The upshot of all of this for you guys is wash your hands with plain old soap and water. There's no need to buy special antibacterial or antimicrobial soaps, unless maybe if you've got someone in your household who's particularly immune deprived. But otherwise, wash your hands before you eat. Don't stick your fingers in your mouth. And in fact, while taking the basic biosafety course at UBC, we did a little experiment where we stuck this Day-Glow gunk on our hands and then wash them for different periods of time. The Day-Glow gunk is basically, it stains bacteria and microbes. And even after 90 seconds, there was still a large number of bacteria left on the hands. So flicking your hands under running water and scaring the bacteria with the prospect of drowning isn't going to cut it. If you really want to make sure that you don't get sick or you don't pass contaminants on, wash your hands for a good minute with vigorous scrubbing and warm water with normal soap, and we'll all be a lot happier. Because apparently, deaths in hospitals alone from resistant bacteria cost taxpayers about $1 million, and hundreds of thousands of people get sick from it, and tens of thousands die from it every year. So it's a little thing, but it's an important thing. There endeth the tirade. This is a song by the Flowbots called Handlebars. If you get a chance to check the video on YouTube, it's pretty cool, actually. Anyway, here it is, Handlebars by the Flowbots.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
Look at me, look at me, hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper even when the paths are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do, I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem, I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friend saw a platypus, me and my friend made a comic book. And guess how long it took, I can do anything that I want. Cause look, I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome,
no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone, on the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, just called to say that it's good to be alive. In such a small world, I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store. I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine, 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run the business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance, because I can lead a nation with a microphone. With a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule, of a molecule, of a molecule. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison, just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command, because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, 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 in a holocaust.
With no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
Hey, this is Steve Nash. You're listening to CITR 101.9, the home of the UBC Thunderbirds.
Don't know what it is about my science project, or probably me in particular, but I have a certain interest in science that has to do with diet and exercise and longevity and... I guess I just want to live a long time, you know? So I have a few stories that I've come across over the last little while that have to do with those three things and how they're interconnected, and I thought I'd share them with you today. The first is something that was reported in the BBC News about a couple months ago, so it's not exactly breaking science, but it's still really cool. And this is a story that was originally published in the journal Behavioral Neuroscience by a group of scientists from Purdue University in the United States. This group believe that a sweet taste followed by no calories may make the body crave extra food. What they did in this study was they fed rats sugar and found that those rats subsequently had lower appetites compared to rats fed with low-calorie sweeteners. Conventional wisdom says that as a part of a calorie-controlled diet, artificial sweeteners can help people lose weight or keep it off. That makes sense, right? If you're not consuming large quantities of sugar but a sugar substitute, you're cutting out all those extra calories. But this Purdue study really flips that wisdom around, and what they did was they gave, I didn't know rats like yogurt, but they gave different yogurt to different groups of rats. Some of the yogurt was sweetened with sugar and some with a substitute called saccharin. The rats were then given a plentiful supply of food and the researchers watched what they ate. It turns out that the rats that were fed saccharin yogurt, so the artificially sweetened yogurt, ate more calories, put on more fat, and ended up gaining more weight than the rats that went for the sugar-sweetened yogurt. The saccharin-fed rats also made no attempt to cut back on their food later to regulate their weight. One theory the scientists came up with to explain this was that in normal conditions, the arrival of a sweet taste in the mouth helps to prime the metabolism for the arrival of a calorie-heavy sweet meal into the digestive system. In the case of the artificially sweetened yogurt, when this meal does not arrive, the scientists speculate that the body may get confused and have more trouble regulating its appetite when there is other food around to eat. So basically, your body is priming itself to go through a lot of calories when it gets a sweet taste, and when it doesn't get those extra calories, it sort of has a bit of a freak out. A spokesman for the British Nutrition Foundation said the study findings were, quote, interesting, but didn't prove that artificial sweeteners could be counterproductive to dieting in human beings. Apparently, there are numerous studies in humans that have shown that low-calorie sweeteners can actually help people lose weight. But it kind of leads back to the concept that why eat a larger portion of, let's say, a Weight Watchers brownie when you can just eat a smaller portion of a really amazing, good, high-calorie brownie and sort of manage your portion control in perhaps a more natural and sensible way. If you use artificial sweeteners a lot, maybe you just want to have a little bit less sugar and use sugar on a regular basis. Now, this story leads very nicely to another story that was published about a month ago, the 26th of March, in Nature. And this also is about taste and sugar. This time the study was done on mice, and researchers found that the mice that they studied preferred sugary water even if they lacked a gene to taste it. Reward centers in the brain reacted when the mice drank water spiked with sucrose, but not when the mice drank water mixed with a low-calorie artificial sweetener. Now, this research was originally published in the journal Neuron in the end of March, and it suggested that mice can detect calories without relying on their taste buds. The presence of a calorie-sensing pathway makes evolutionary sense, says the author of the study, Ivan de Orojo, now at Yale University. And he says that the taste system evolved to allow animals to quickly detect what is worth eating as opposed to what is not. The real reward that they need is not the taste itself, but the calories that the animal is getting in the food. The new study used mice that lacked a protein called TRPM5, and this protein absence basically makes the mice unable to detect either sweet or bitter tastes, so they're essentially completely taste blind. Despite the taste blindness, the mutant mice learned to favor sugar water just as much as normal mice. They did not, however, favor water sweetened with sucralose, which is a low-calorie artificial sweetener. And this data suggests that the mouse body does not learn from taste, but rather from the calories in the sugar. At this particular time, the researchers don't really know why this is going on. They don't have a mechanism for how the mice can detect calories without doing it through taste. So the researchers can only speculate that perhaps there's a dopamine-producing system in the brain that detects appetite-related hormones, and somehow that's involved in this detection of calories versus taste. It'd be interesting to see if human beings actually do this too. And this sort of leads actually to the next story. This was published in Nature originally, and this is a slightly older story. It goes back to the fall, October in particular, of 2007. But it goes along the lines of a key signaling hormone that tells the brain when the stomach is full communicates with cognitive reward areas in the brain. The study is the first physiological demonstration that pleasure circuits play a key role in driving eating habits. Maybe this sounds like proving the obvious, because lots of us like to go to the ice cream when we're feeling particularly down, but this is the first scientific study that is actually pointing to a mechanism. Researchers have debated for a long time whether feeding behavior is dominated by what they call the homeostatic demands of the hypothalamus, which is basically your brain indicating that you have a physical need to eat, or by a reward-based signal or signals sent from cognitive areas, which is basically science for you're getting signals from the brain telling you that you have a psychological or pleasure-based need to eat. Animal studies have suggested the former hypothesis, meaning that basically hunger and eating is driven by physical need, by these signals that are sent from the lower, sort of a lower level part of the brain. But psychologists have long known that reward plays a part in human eating patterns. And again, I suppose it's interesting to interject at this point that humans have culture as opposed to mice. I don't think mice have any cultural traits, but we certainly, even if mice do have cultural traits, humans have a way more sophisticated cultural system, and we have a lot of things that are wrapped up in eating and in food. And so perhaps for us, reward plays a much bigger role than in any kind of rodent model. But anyway, that's sort of by the by. And getting back to the study, which was spearheaded by someone named Rachel Batterham of University College London, she and her colleagues examined this question, whether it was, you know, physiologically based or psychologically based, by imaging the brains of subjects, these were human beings, exposed to peptide YY, thought to be a signal that tells you when you're full. And they looked at these, the brains of these subjects before a meal and after fasting. After 14 hours without food, subjects were given an intravenous drip of either the hormone at levels that would mimic a 1,500-calorie meal or a placebo for 90 minutes while their brain was scanned continuously. And then they were given an unlimited meal, which could basically mean they were lined up at a buffet. Each volunteer was tested twice, once with the peptide, the PYY, and once with the placebo in a completely random order. It turns out that the subjects reduced the amount that they ate by an average of 25% after receiving the hormone drip. The biggest change in brain activity in response to PYY occurred in a region implicated in emotional and reward processing in the brain. So basically, the people who got the satiety signal, this peptide, this PYY, who received this through the intravenous drip, ate a quarter less food than the subjects who just got the placebo drip. When volunteers received the placebo rather than PYY after fasting, the major change in activity occurred instead in the hypothalamus, and this was correlated to how much they ate. So basically, those individuals who had not eaten for a long time and got the placebo had a driving signal from their sort of lower brain area, the physical area of the brain that doesn't have to do with reward or pleasure, but instead has to do with telling your body that you simply need to take calories on board. So one possible explanation for these results is that when people are fasted, their drive to eat comes predominantly from more primitive brain centers. When they've been fed, the drive comes from the anticipated pleasure or value of the food. It's possible that targeting reward signaling pathways that have to do with eating could provide new targets for treating obesity and eating disorders. It's also just really cool. This is a classic from Weird Al Yankovic.
Yo, homeboy, where you been, man? We been looking for you.
Yeah, we ain't seen you around Burger World lately. So where you been, huh?
Oh, you know, around.
Want a piece of pizza? Think I got an extra piece around here somewhere.
No, that's okay, thanks.
Yo, ding dong, man. Ding dong. Ding dong, yo.
No, thanks, really.
Yo, eat this, man. It's good for you.
I'm not really very hungry right now.
Hey, man, what it is with you? You on some kind of diet? Is that what they teach in that little sissy school of yours?
Back off me, man. Back off.
The question is, are you fat or what?
Leave me alone.
I said, are you fat?
fat. Get off me, man. Stop it.
You ain't down with us no more. You ain't fat. You ain't fat.
You ain't fat. You ain't nothing. You ain't nothing.
Just watch your mouth, or I'll sit on you. The word is out, better treat me right. Cause I'm the king of cellulite. Ham on, whole wheat. All right. My zippers bust, my buckles break. I'm too much man for you to take. The pavement cracks when I fall down. I've got more chins than Chinatown. But I never used a phone booth. But I never seen my toes. When I'm going to the movies, I take up seven rows because I'm fat, fat, I'm fat. Come on, really, really fat. You know I'm fat, fat, I'm fat. You know it, really, really fat. You know I'm fat, fat, I'm fat. Come on, really, really you know. Fat. Don't you call me pudgy, portly, or stout. Just tell me once again who's fat.
These next few stories are kind of a continuation of what we were just talking about, eating and diet and calories. And this next one is, it was recently published, just actually the 5th of May, in The Scientist. This is describing a study that was published May 4th in Nature that reported that the number of fat cells in any person's body is determined during childhood and stays constant throughout life, with about 10% of fat cells dying and being replaced annually. So human beings generate quite a few fat cells, says Kirsty Spalding, who is a biologist at Sweden's Karolinska Institute and the first author of the study, but the number of cells seems to be really tightly regulated. Both the expansion of the fat cell population and the arrival at what will be the final number of fat cells in our bodies, these are also called adipocytes, in the adult body occur at an earlier age in obese people. So basically, fatter people experience a period of rapid fat cell production around the age of 2 years and reach their adult number of fat cells when they're about 16 and a half years old. This is in large contrast to people who are lean. Lean kids recruit fat cells most rapidly at about the age of 6, so 4 years after the fatter people do, and their fat cell population reaches adult size at about 18 and a half years old, so another 2 years after an obese young adult or teenager would do. To study how fat cell numbers differ in heftier or lighter people, Spalding and her team examined fat biopsies from about 680 lean and obese Swedes, and they found obese people can have as much as twice the number of fat cells as lean people do. The next plan in the study is to determine fat cell population dynamics in people who are lean as children but become obese as adults. It's kind of weird to think that your fat cells are finite and established at such a young age. Moving along to fat and exercise and longevity. This was a study that was published at the beginning of 2008 that found that active people could be up to 10 years, quote-unquote, younger physiologically than people who are what you would call couch potatoes. Tim Spector, who is director of the Twin Research Unit at St. Thomas's Hospital in London, England, looked at the levels of physical activity of a huge population of twins, almost 2,500 twins. And he assessed the length of their telomeres. Telomeres are basically the caps at the ends of your chromosomes, and they help protect the DNA from wearing down during the replication process that replenishes the cells in your body. So basically, the telomeres stop your DNA from fraying as it gets read and various genes get expressed. Telomeres normally shorten over an individual's lifetime and are thought to function as a marker for aging, in part for this reason. Smokers and obese people are already known to have shorter telomeres than healthier counterparts of the same age. Now, Tim Spector's team found that on average, telomeres in the most active group that they studied, and this group took more than 3 hours 20 minutes of exercise a week, were 200 nucleotides longer than that of the least active group, who took less than 16 minutes exercise a week. The difference in nucleotide length suggests that inactive subjects may be biologically older by 10 years compared with more active subjects, based on the normal degradation of the length of the telomere. The researchers also looked at matched pairs of twins and found an average difference of 88 nucleotides between more or less active siblings. So even in people who are meant to be pretty much genetically identical and are of the same age, there's about 100 nucleotide difference in their telomere length. The trick about this study is the group can't be certain that activity levels are actually having a direct impact on telomere length. It's just a correlation. There's no mechanism explaining the link. However, the researchers did correct for the impact of smoking, obesity, social status, and other possibly confounding factors, which does support the idea that exercise and telomere length are somehow linked. If inactivity is to blame for shorter telomeres in equivalently aged person, it's possible that the faster cells are replenished, the faster telomeres shrink, but physically inactive people are for some reason experiencing a high cell turnover, basically leading to shorter telomeres. Another possible explanation leads in oxidative stress, or we hear about free radicals. Oxidative stress is this sort of idea of free radicals being around in your body and wreaking all kinds of havoc. They suggest that more reactive oxygen atoms or oxygen molecules are created and stress the cells. It's possible that exercise is required to damp down oxidative stress. But a slightly different hypothesis that's a bit unusual is that a little bit of oxidative stress is caused by exercise, and for some reason, this little bit of stress actually helps out with cells. Clearly, a lot more work is needed to pin down a causal link. But it does lend a little bit more support to the idea that if you go to the gym for about an hour a week, three times a week, you're probably going to have, if not a longer life, a better quality of life for the time that you're on the planet. This last one has nothing to do with humans. It has to do with ants, and it's really cool. There is a scientist from a university in Poland, Jagiellonian University, who, I have to say, in Poland this wouldn't matter, but in North America he has the unfortunate luck of having the last name Moron. So Dr. Moron of Poland carried out a set of laboratory experiments showing that ants have the ability to gauge the end of their lifespan and to use their assessment of imminent mortality to take bigger risks with their aging lives. This would be the equivalent of our parents or grandparents deciding to, I don't know, go fight a war or act as firefighters or do some kind of incredibly higher risk activity because they realize that they have less time to live. It's well established that worker ants tend to take greater risks as they get older. Scientists have shown that this behavioral trait benefits the colony because certain risky activities, for example, foraging far from the nest, are best done by ants coming to the end of their useful lives because it doesn't pay to put young workers in high-risk jobs. What Dr. Moran believed is that it might be possible to manipulate an ant's lifespan artificially and to observe changes to its risk-taking behavior as a result. His study was published in the journal Animal Behavior, and this was just at the end of 2007. And what he basically did was he increased the concentration of carbon dioxide in the chamber housing an ant's nest. High concentrations of CO2 increase acidity in the blood of the ant and curtail its lifespan. So this idea is that the technique is gradual and it's predictable, and it's one which the ant should be able to exploit to estimate how much time it has left before it dies. As the scientists predicted, the worker ants in the colony began to forage further afield earlier than they would have done if they'd been brought up in a low CO2 atmosphere. The findings are further evidence of apparent altruism in the ant. The workers are not only prepared to sacrifice their lives to serve and protect their queen, they also have the ability to make careful calculations of just how much risk they should take based on their current life expectancy. The idea about altruism and how this could evolve in a world of selfish genes was resolved about four decades ago by someone named William Hamilton, who was at Oxford University, and he showed that the altruism seen in ants and other social insects could be explained by something called kin selection. Basically, kin selection means that a female worker ant is prepared to die for her sister queen because in insects, which have an unusual genetics compared to, let's say, us, it makes sisters more related to one another than they are to their own offspring. So helping out your sister actually does benefit you in a way because the genes that are passed down are so close to your own. So I thought that was really interesting to be able to sense just how much longer you have in terms of a lifespan and then do stuff about it. Translates very oddly to human culture, I think. Some handy, interesting facts about ants that you can impress your friends, colleagues, and family with are that ants are the most prolific species on the planet. The combined weight of the Earth's ants outweighs that of humans, and they have the highest population of any animal on Earth. Ants know how to look after their queens. A queen ant can live for up to 30 years, while male workers generally survive for only a few weeks. There are more than 12,000 different species of ant, and they range in size from 2 millimeters to about an inch, or 25 millimeters. And ants, as you probably know, are surprisingly strong and fast. They can lift 20 times their own body weight and run so fast that if we could move as quickly for their size, then we would be as fast as racehorses. Interestingly, ants have two stomachs, one for their food and the other for the ants in the colony. And lastly, ants are remarkably tidy, Some worker ants take on the job of taking the nest's waste to an outside rubbish dump. Yay, ants! You're listening to my science project on CITR 101.9 FM.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
There is a war going on for your mind. Media mavens mount surgical strikes from trapper keeper collages and online magazine racks. Cover girl cutouts throw up pop-up ads infecting victims with silicone shrapnel. Worldwide passenger pigeons deployed paratroopers. Now it's raining pornography. Lovers take shelter. Post-production debutantes pursue you in NASCAR chariots. They construct ransom letters from biblical passages and bleed mascara into the holy water supplies. There is a war going on for your mind. Industry insiders slang test tube babies to corporate crackheads. They flash logos and blast ghettos. Their embroidered neckties say, stop snitching. Conscious rappers and whistleblowers get stitches made of acupuncture needles and marionette strings. There is a war going on for your mind. Professional wrestlers and vice presidents want you to believe them. The desert sky is their blue screen. They superimpose explosions. They shout at you. Pay no attention to the men behind the barred curtain, nor the craters beneath the draped flags. Those hoods are there for your protection, and the medias these days are the size of corpses. There is a war going on for your mind.
And we are back to my science project on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Julia. And we just heard another song by the Flowbots. It's time now to share with you some science events that are going on around town and other tidbits you might be interested in getting involved with. But this next event I'm super excited about. This is going to be fantastic, and I'm so sad that I'm not able to come to Vancouver from Calgary to be here for it. And if you at all can make it down, you completely should. This is a really special Café Scientifique. Café Sci, for our regular listeners, you'll know that this is an event that happens monthly. My co-host Anne is an organizer of the event, and it's a free forum that happens usually the third Tuesday of each month downtown at the Railway Club, where Anne and her partner in crime, Jamie, bring in a scientist to talk about some kind of really cool research that's going on. And people chat over beer about it afterwards, and it's just a great environment. And Jamie, Anne, and I managed to score some money from the Canadian Institute of Health Research, or CIHR, who are also really keen on science communication, and so they have some small grants that they are giving out for people who want to run a special Café Sci. So what's going on this month, at the end of May, particularly on May 27th, which is a Tuesday, there's going to be a really special CIHR-funded Café Sci called The Future of Science. Leading scientists reveal the questions they'd love to answer. This is going to be an excellent panel. We've got on this panel Dr. John Fife, who's a specialist in climate change. He's a research scientist at the Canadian Centre for Climate Modelling and Analysis and an adjunct prof at the University of Victoria. And he's also one of the Nobel laureates who won the Peace Prize for his work writing the report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In addition to John Fife, Dr. Fiona Brinkman, who specializes in pathogenomics and systems biology, which is essentially work focusing on improving understanding about disease and improving computational methods that help develop new vaccines, drugs, and diagnostics for infectious diseases. And so Dr. Fiona Brinkman is going to be joining us. She is associate prof in the Department of Molecular Biology and Biochem at Simon Fraser University. The third person on the panel is also from SFU. Dee Pankur Sen is a professor in the Department of Molecular Biology and Biochemistry / Chemistry at SFU, and he is a specialist in DNA nanotechnology. So we've got climate change, disease and systems biology, DNA nanotechnology, and the final person involved in this cafe is the moderator, Dr. Michael McDonald. And Michael McDonald is a professor at the University of British Columbia and also the director of the Center for Applied Ethics. And he's a Cafe Sci veteran. We had him, I think, back in 2005. He came with a colleague of his to talk about ethics in particularly medical research. So these four folks are going to be showing up Tuesday, May 27th, at 7:30 in the evening at Steamworks. So if you're used to Cafe Sci being at the Railway Club, please take note. This event, because it's going to be a bigger event, it's happening at Steamworks, which is just down the road from the Railway Club. It's located at 375 Water Street in Vancouver, of course. And you can visit the website for Steamworks at www.steamworks.com. The event in particular is happening in the Harbor View Room, but there will be tons of signage, I am sure, and you will be able to find your way very easily. This event, like any other Café Scientifique event, is completely free and completely open to anybody. So particularly if you are a non-scientist, come on down. If you're a scientist, grab a non-scientist's friend, drag them along. And in addition to being a free event, there are also going to be free snacks. Yes, free hors d'oeuvre and a cash bar, which is what we normally have at the Railway Club. So you're going to get some nosh for free, the event for free. It's going to be amazing. So mark your calendars now, May 27th, 7:30 at Steamworks. If you need more information or you'd like to confirm, because an RSVP for this event, since it's so big, would be really appreciated, you can email to myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca and contact Anne or I and let us know what you think. And if you're interested in showing up, we hope to see you all there. Come and say hello. The next two things that I would like to mention to you guys are something called Cool Cities. Now, Cool Cities is a program that the Sierra Club of Canada is rolling out. It's a campaign that they roll out in communities across Canada. Basically, the point of Cool Cities is that it's a network of activists who take the lead on climate change in cities and towns across Canada by advocating practical action by municipal governments. Half of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions are under direct control of municipalities, making the role of cities and towns absolutely key to reducing Canada's contribution to global climate change. The campaign in Calgary is kicking off on May 26th. I know that Vancouver is certainly a part of the Cool Cities campaign, and indeed many cities in BC and the GVRD are involved. So if you would like to help out in any way, if you would like to lead a local campaign in your city, all you have to do is visit www.coolcities.ca. That's C-O-O-L-C-I-T-I-E-S cityscoolyear.ca to find out more about how you can get involved with the Cool Cities campaign that is spearheaded by the Sierra Club of Canada. The last thing that I wanted to promote to you guys is something that's basically sponsored by the Minerva Foundation of BC Women. And these are the Minerva Foundation's Education Awards. The application deadline for these awards is coming up fast, so take note, it's within a month. The deadline is June 2nd. And the awards are set up to help British Columbia women advance themselves by continuing their education. The objectives and basically the target groups and the eligibility for these education awards are to first assist single moms in advancing their education, or to retrain mature women who are returning to work after a long absence. It's also to advance women in non-traditional fields of study. And lastly, the Minerva Foundation hopes with these education awards to assist immigrant and Aboriginal women and women with a disability to overcome educational barriers. So if you fit any of those criteria, or you know someone who does, who is thinking about continuing their education, you can visit the website of the Minerva Foundation for BC Women. And that is www.TheMinervaFoundation, and Minerva is spelled M-I-N-E-R-V-A. So www.TheMinervaFoundation.com, which will take you to the awards page, but if you want the full URL, it's /awards/application.html. And this was a notice put out by the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology, or SQIST, so you can probably get info through the SQIST website. Just to tease you with some of the money on offer, there's one award worth $10,000, and then a few awards worth $1,000 each, and then a few smaller denominations for awards. But there's 6 awards in total. Some of them are given out to more than one applicant. So, yeah. If you think that you might be eligible, by all means, go for it.
I'm at war. I'm at war with myself. I'm at war with you. I'm at war with everybody. That's why I don't do drugs, because I don't want to be numb. I want to feel the pain. I want the clarity of the challenge. I want to win. I want to kick in the head. I want to tear the throat box out. I want to smash in the lungs. I want to kick in the rib cage. I want to split the spine. And I want to use your phone, make love to your wife, sister, eat your dog, and leave your house with a good cassette.
CITR 101.9 FM, where there's just a little bit of Kim Fowley in each and every one of us.
No, I don't think so.